The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, December 22nd, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on the Thursday before Christmas. Yes, there's a few more shopping days out there, shopping hours, I guess, as we count down to the holidays and think about what's happened this year. I mean, of all the recent years, this one hits the finish line tape in a real blur, don't you think? I mean, what possible single image could even come close to signifying this year? Some people have the job of actually picking one. Time's pick of Donald Trump as person of the year was a huge duh. I mean, what else are they going to do, right? Except if you think about it, so much else more happened in 2016 than just Donald Trump, even just in the election. You know, I think the New York Times might consider renaming this year's Year in Photos feature something like Pixels at an Exhibition, just for the sheer randomness of 2016.
Hi, this is Karen Hayes from East Northport, New York. The picture that resonated the most for me from 2016 was the picture of Hillary Clinton walking in the woods with her dog the day after she lost the election.
My name is Tony Toll from Granbury, Texas. The photo of the boy in the ambulance in Aleppo. It is the face of every other photo I have collected, of all of the genocides that mankind has inflicted on one another throughout history.
It was a scene of a bunch of people standing around a stack of television sets, watching, you know, a number of, like, soccer games.
And Alec Baldwin doing Donald Trump.
I've never met Putin. What is even a Putin?
It was a crazy year.
So today, the New York Times is posting its annual Year in Photos, and Jeffrey Scales is photo editor at the New York Times. This is a big job, I suspect.
Yeah, I've been doing it for many years, but you know, I have to go through about 150 to 200,000 photos.
Wow.
It's a pretty immersive process for me. I start about 5 weeks ago.
And you really get a sense of January 1st was about a billion years ago in history.
It was a long time ago. But, you know, we break it up month to month. And I try to get it down to around 100. This year, I think it came in around 135. There was a lot of things and, you know, a lot of events.
Well, describe to me the picture that really stands out for you as far as Ben is concerned.
I literally just finished editing the year in pictures yesterday. So, you know, I'm looking at this one picture of Hillary that I'm familiar with, you know, and it's, as I said earlier, you know, it's an exhilarating picture of her at probably one of the best moments of her life. And it's a great vantage point. There's an immediacy to it. And, you know, it's just really well done.
What were you doing when you took that picture of Hillary Clinton, Ben?
Well, I was working in the buffer during the DNC. There's, you know, the area.
It's like the rave pit?
Yeah, basically. it's the area right in front of the candidates where we've all been, all the photographers who work in there have been screened. And kind of we all know each other. We kind of do it year in, year out. It's the same big publications and big wires. And it's kind of like this really great camaraderie that works down in there. And basically, we never listen to the speeches. So we're all down there on our knees. I wear volleyball knee pads underneath my slacks because you have to spend about 3 hours of the night on your knees waiting for just the moment where the candidate steps back from the microphone. And, you know, in one of these brief interludes where the crowd is clapping, and that's where we can all stand up and pull a Hail Mary to try and make an image where they don't have a microphone in front of their face. And we're not allowed to use, you know, flash photography. You're not allowed to use anything that would distract them. So it's more of like you know, especially with Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump in both the RNC and DNC, you knew that when they finished speaking, that was when the confetti was going to come down, when the Secret Service was going to, like, take a step back and let us kind of shoot these unguarded moments. And I think a lot of us kind of were just waiting to prepare for those moments when that happened.
And you saw her at a particularly happy moment. Did you get a sense of that as you pulled the trigger?
I mean, I want to say that image that I made was probably the most unguarded. I'd ever seen, or just this one moment of happiness where most of the rest of the time on the campaign trail, both candidates are so in their little bubble and so guarded. But this was probably the most unguarded moment where you actually saw genuine emotion from Hillary Clinton. And, you know, I just wanted to be ready to capture that.
Is Trump a particular problem? It seems to me there's a category of really scary pictures of Donald Trump, really ridiculous pictures of Donald Trump, and then a fairly small subset of presidential pictures of Donald Trump. How challenging is that?
Well, there's a lot of pictures of Donald Trump. He is a TV personality. He does a lot of events. It's all lit up. You know, it's controlled like any big production. But there's just a lot of them, you know, and he's a bit of a character in terms of his presentation.
How many got into the photos?
Into the New York Times photos of the year? I probably put three.
Stephanie Keith is also with us here in the studio. And the big story out west was the Dakota Access protests. And she has a photograph from those protests that she took for Reuters, which is part of the New York Times Year in Photos. Stephanie, how many days were you there?
I was there for 41 days, but on assignment for 36 mm-hmm. continuous days.
And it went from chilly to really chilly, I would suspect.
When I first arrived, my first day was on Halloween, and it was pretty warm during the day. Mm-hmm. You had to really wear a lot of layers, and it was 60 degrees a lot of times during the day. So for the first 3 weeks, it was pretty unseasonably warm. And then the last 2 weeks, it was incredibly cold. There were two blizzards like right in a row, mm-hmm. and it was 0 degrees. There were winds of 30 to 50 miles an hour. And, you know, you still had to work in that.
Jeffrey, describe Stephanie's picture that really struck you.
Well, it's a remarkable picture. I believe it was in November when it was cold.
It was November 20th.
And the police or the military, it's the police, I believe, are using fire hoses to try to disperse the crowd in it. And it's an epic picture. It reminds me of one of the Walter Turnbull 18th century paintings of the Revolutionary War. But it's just a remarkable moment. And being out there where they're spraying the water, you know, trying to make a photo. I mean, that's, you know, what makes great photography is photojournalism specifically is, you know, getting it close up and, you know, being right there and still being able to make, you know, a good photo because it looks like it was pretty difficult conditions. I mean, and the same with Ben at an event like that where, you know, as he said, he had to like sit there for 3 hours and then get up and, you know, try to be in the right place and hope, you know, the person comes over there. But this is a remarkable picture.
Stephanie, how did you know you were in the right place?
Well, I got tipped off earlier in that day in a kind of an unusual way. Like, I had been there for 3 weeks, so people sort of knew me. And I was waiting at the South Gate for another action to take place. And then a pickup truck with two Sioux elders came by. And the woman on the passenger side was like, "Why are you here waiting for the action? You really need to think about why you're here." We were all a little confused. And she said, "Instead of going on this action, you need to go to the medical tent and get a gas mask and get goggles. Then you need to go to the donation tent and you need to get two pairs of warm clothes." And she said that there was a decision that was going to be made today. And when that decision is made, we're going to need everyone in camp. And then she drove off. So I was like, okay, well, something big is going to happen today. So I went to my car and I got my gas mask ready because Reuters had sent out a security kit for me. And I just waited and waited and waited all day. They had a big meeting with only the Lakota Sioux people that lasted from 11 to 4:30 in the afternoon. And that was the longest meeting I'd ever known ever to take place. And nothing happened, but another woman I knew was like, "You better stick around in camp. You really should stay in camp, Stephanie," she kept saying to me. I stayed in camp, and at nightfall, I was in the camp, and I heard someone say something, "Oh, they're taking the injured people off the front line." And I was like, "The injured people off the front line?" So I went up to where the front line was, which is a road just outside of camp, just a little north of camp, and I just saw an entire field filled up with tear gas, and then the water cannon or fire hose, you know, spraying over the crowd. And I was like, okay, well, this is it. This is what those people were talking about. And it lasted a long time. It lasted from like 7 o'clock in the evening until, you know, well past midnight.
How did you keep the sense of the drama of the characters who were risking so much in the photo and keep it just from becoming this fog of war, spray, gas? It's so easy for pictures like that to look chaotic.
A lot of my pictures, if I look at the ones that I edited out, do look very chaotic. But I find with photography, I think it's really important when you're telling a story of a group of people to really focus in on singular experiences, because I often feel that the more you focus on singular experiences, the more you're actually saying about the event in general. So I try to find singular people that are struggling or doing something interesting, important, and focus on them. And, you know, I found that I worked very slowly, though, because it was so chaotic. I didn't want to get caught up in the chaos. So I kind of hung back for a little while and just watched what the police were doing. And I found if you watch them carefully, you could see a pattern. And they would do the water cannons first. Then they would do the tear gas. And then they would do the rubber bullets. Within that pattern, I could sort of time my approach because I knew I needed to get close as possible to the front line so that I can really show what was going on. But I didn't want to get my gear wet. It was 20 degrees that night. There were icicles hanging off of the concertina wire. So I really had to time my approach carefully. So I would go up sometimes and photograph right on the front lines. And then when the police pattern changed, I would pull back again, especially when they were tear gassing. And then I would go up again and pull back again. And, you know,
interesting in terms of what Stephanie was just saying. She's of the Kappa school, what they say, if your pictures aren't good enough, you're not close enough.
You know, Robert Kappa.
Yeah. And also, Deanne Arbus had an expression that was, the more specific you are, the more general you become in terms of your work. So both of those elements, how you describe your approach to making that photograph. I mean, and the same with bands, you know, close, you know, get close. And it's because then you're part of it. You're part of the actual experience.
Stephanie and Ben and Jeffrey, thank you so much. And congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks to Ben Lowy, photographer who covered the election for Time magazine. His photo of Hillary Clinton celebrating her nomination at the DNC made the publication's top 100 photographs for the year. Stephanie Keith, thanks to you, newspaper and wire photographer for the New York Times, Getty, and Reuters. And Jeffrey Scales, photo editor at the Times, who edited the Times Year in Pictures coming out today. If you want to see Stephanie and Ben's work, go to thetakeaway.org. Also, send us your favorite picture. Tweet us at The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International. In collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The manhunt is still underway in Germany for a Tunisian man suspected to have carried out Monday's truck attack at a Christmas market in Berlin, Germany. The profile of the suspect represents a political problem for the German government and invites criticism of Chancellor Angela Merkel's immigration policies. Constanze Stelzenmüller is a senior fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Constanze, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think this attack is a turning point in modern German history in the sense that we've been moving forward uninterrupted on this embrace of migrants and sort of the open Germany policy, and this is all of a sudden a possible setback?
You know, I think that's wildly overburdening the earned interpretation of this event. It's certainly a milestone in that it was the first major terrorist attack in modern German history. But honestly, both the authorities in Germany and the German public knew that at some point this was going to happen. In an open society with many, many soft targets that you can't defend without making them completely, you know, closing them off and closing off society, this, I think many people had a feeling of inevitability.
So there's enough political preparation for this event to stay the course and to keep moving forward, even regardless of the criticism of Angela Merkel particularly.
Look, I mean, it's obvious that all of Merkel's enemies within her own party, within the Bavarian sister party, CSU, those being her rivals, are her political real enemies, and they're in right-wing and left-wing populist parties, that they're trying to blame this on her. One particularly egregious tweet called the deaths of these people killed by the truck on Monday, the Merkel's dead. I mean, that's scandalous, but it's also wrong. It's I think most Germans felt that surprised and concerned that the German state, the German institutions, seemed so overwhelmed by the migrant influx. But the reality is that this influx has trickled down to manageable numbers. The ones that have arrived have been distributed. And there's an ongoing, if slow and somewhat chaotic, process of returning people, or to not use a euphemism, deporting them if they haven't gotten asylum status. One of the problems with the Tunisian guy, who's now the main suspect in this attack, is that he had no papers and that the Tunisian authorities in his home state had been slow in supplying them. This was slowing down the deportation process.
What do you think about the public appreciation or criticism of the investigation that's gone on? Is this a collision of security policy and a sense of wanting not to be living in a state where there's surveillance constantly? Is there a discussion of changing the rules?
You know, again, I honestly think it's important to not overinterpret this. I am living in D.C., but I am often in Berlin. I have many, many friends there. I lived there for 10 years before I moved here. And from what I see of my friends and acquaintances' postings on Facebook and elsewhere, the mood is pretty calm and not all that critical. Now, again, I mean, I can understand why people are trying to politically exploit this, but the reality is that the authorities have been moving carefully and calmly, and I don't at this point see any sort of disastrous mishaps. Yes, it's true that Germans dislike surveillance cameras. Half of the country, or let's say 4/10 of the country, the former East Germany, you know, until 1989, lived in a state of constant surveillance. You can understand why that's not culturally particularly popular. I think that that might change. I think we might have a, you know, reinforcement of police and domestic intelligence. But that was well underway, and it's been well underway, frankly, since the attacks of 9/11 and the kind of international collaboration that was created at the time.
So the suspicion would be that Angela Merkel will run for re-election next year. Is that still up in the air?
She's already said she would several weeks ago. I have mixed feelings about this. I have great admiration for her. I think she's been a very strong and good chancellor. But fourth terms, you know, Americans don't like dynasties, whether they're called Bush or Clintons. And in Germany, fourth term attempts have usually not ended well. Germans are as keen to preserve democracy and political change as other Western democracies.
Would you say that a change in the leadership in Berlin would change Germany's role as leader in this Europe project that is so in turmoil since Brexit?
That's really hard to say. She's one of the European Union's staunchest defenders. And perhaps for American listeners, the reason why we feel so strongly about this is that most of us have parents or grandparents who have memories of the war, who have, you know, made an effort for reconciliation with a people tormented, killed, massacred by our Nazi ancestors. And we have borders with 9 other countries in Europe. For us, it's unimaginable to live in a Europe where all the borders are pulled up again and where people don't talk to each other. This is about peace, prosperity, stability, and yes, democratic transformation, including in my own country. And so I have a hard time thinking that somebody who replaced Merkel, whether at the elections in 2017 or at any other point, you know, would feel any differently about this project unless that person was a populist. And for this point, at this point, I don't see Germans electing a populist as the next chancellor. I'm happy to say that I think we can safely exclude that.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is the Robert Bosch Senior Fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Well, it'll be very interesting to see what wild cards are in the deck in the German elections as that transpires over the next several months. Constanze, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Here's a completely different look at the picture of the year idea. There are some instances where it's just as well you don't win a photo award. The power of photos in implicating governments and atrocities and confirming the location of people on the run makes it important that sometimes a photo's source remain a secret. Last week, more than 150 documentary filmmakers and photojournalists signed on to an open letter to camera giants like Nikon, Canon, and Olympus, calling for the manufacturers to build encryption technology into their products to help protect the individuals behind the lens. Harlow Holmes is director of Newsroom Digital Security at Freedom of the Press Foundation, which organized the letter. Harlow, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How would this work? The technology would actually allow the photographer to put an anonymity cloak on the camera itself?
Not necessarily, because ultimately these photographers, filmmakers want their images to get out into the world. What it's mostly about is controlling when the photos or videos can be accessed and by whom.
And that would protect the individuals how?
It protects in a number of ways. For instance, when you're doing border crossings, this is something that journalists do quite frequently. You often have, you know, your footage gone through, perhaps even destroyed or deleted.
Well, let's take that instance for a second.
Yes.
So the technological countermeasure would be you'd flick a switch and it would be on security mode and there'd be no way for the people at the checkpoint to get at it? Or would it flick a switch and pretend as though there's no pictures there?
No. The encryption does not include obfuscation. That's a totally different thing.
So if there was a case where you're crossing a border and the camera shows that there are pictures but you can't get at them, I mean, just put a gun to the head of the photographer, right? I mean,
that is, quite frankly, that is something that people face in a variety of situations quite frequently. And we're definitely not trying to claim that this would be a solution to that problem. What it is it's about the protection of the footage itself.
In terms of security for photographers, how much of the protection of the photographers themselves is a part of this letter?
Encryption itself cannot perform physical protection of people. It is a really, really excellent capability that is built into a number of devices, but we do recognize that there is, you know, political and, you know, socio-political restrictions to how it can be leveraged. And we're not necessarily trying to address that. That said, you know, encryption is a standard right now, and it's something that we rely upon to keep the information that we work with safe. So while it's very, very important to realize that the photographers and filmmakers and documentarians who are pushing for advanced encryption have a lot at stake, but we do want to people to recognize that this is only one tool that will advance the work that they're trying to do, not necessarily solve all of these dangerous problems that they face, that we appreciate that they face.
We certainly don't want to protect ISIS photographers here. That's a whole other question. Finally, Nikon, Canon, and Olympus, are they interested in cooperating here?
So far, the reception has been kind of lukewarm at best. It's going to take a while for manufacturers to understand how they can effectively work that into, you know, product lines in the future. That said, though, I do think that there's, you know, a great need for encryption to be built into professional hardware. And quite frankly, if these manufacturers don't address this need in some way, other, you know, manufacturers are going to eat their lunch.
Harlow Holmes is director of newsroom digital security at Freedom of the Press Foundation, which organized the open letter on encryption to Nikon, Canon, and Olympus. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Kids in trouble need advocates, so that doesn't mean lawyers, and it doesn't necessarily mean surrogate replacement parents either. In 2014, 415,000 children passed through the foster care system in the U.S. Most foster children spend almost 2 years in state care, and 22,000 of them turned 18 without ever being linked to a permanent family. Foster children also face abuse and neglect within the system, the very thing that took them from their families in the first place. Someone who knows what it takes to advocate for those more than 400,000 vulnerable kids is Marsha Robinson Lowry. She's worked on behalf of these vulnerable children for 50 years. In 2014, she founded and now runs A Better Childhood, a nonprofit advocacy organization.
What I do, what ABC does, is system-wide cases to say, here are some examples of kids, but overall, there's too little money. The caseloads are too high. You don't have enough foster homes. The rate of maltreatment in care is too high, that kind of stuff. So what we try to do, and we've often succeeded in doing, is move the system into a different place so that kids get a better shot, that the structure is better. In Texas, we just had a judge find last year that the system's unconstitutional in its treatment of kids in foster care. And it's made foster care one of the top political priorities in the state, which would not have happened without the lawsuit.
Is abuse the result of opportunity in the sense that here are kids and here are adults? Or are there particular pathologies that lead to abusive foster care homes that need to be vetted and screened?
Well, theoretically, all these families are screened. But sometimes the kids are smacked by parents who don't have patience with them. Some of these kids have behavior problems, of course. Sometimes it's a bad fit. The foster parent's taking the kid in because they want to supplement the income, and they'll take the kid. There are people who are pathological. More often it's opportunity. There's nobody to stop them. It's a power thing, too. But mostly these children need affection. They need a family member. And they need somebody that they can feel as a family member. And all too often, I can't tell you how many times kids have said to me, nobody loves me. And one kid was evaluated by a psychiatrist in the context of one of the cases. And he asked her, who loves her? And she said, nobody. And he said, who do you love? And she said, nobody.
Oh.
We need to protect them and create an environment for them where they feel like they've got a family. We don't do that often enough.
What kind of questions do children ask you when they realize that you're there fighting on their behalf?
I represent the whole group of kids in foster care in the state, so I don't meet most of them. But when I talk to them, they ask me questions about when am I going to go home? When am I going to get a mommy? Why won't anybody let me go out? A young man in the Texas case, very bright guy, really had academic ambitions, now is in college, wanted to go to the after-school chess club, wasn't allowed. These are young people who have ambitions, like everybody else, who want to have a decent life.
How significant would you say the population of foster care kids is in terms of contributing to mental health, criminality, you know, social needs in the United States right now?
There's no question but that foster care is the feeder system for other systems that deal with dysfunction. Some of the kids that I worked with in Texas, when they were shown the door in foster care, slept on roofs, prostituted themselves for money. Had no means of living. Well, how are young people who have nothing and nobody to pick up the phone and call, how are they going to live productive lives? And we're spending $30 billion to graduate these young people who have been miserable and were under government's protection, and we're not helping them.
Marsha Lowry, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Marsha Robinson Lowry is a lawyer and the founder and executive director of A Better Childhood.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, brain training developed by scientists and game designers who turn cognitive research tasks into games to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at lumosity.com.
South Sudan is a part of 2016's sadder moments and images. A country brand new to the world in 2011 is seen to be coming apart even before it had much of a chance as a sovereign nation. United Nations experts say there are warning signs of an oncoming genocide. Over 2 million people have fled the Central African country in 3 years. Militias in South Sudan have started to mobilize along ethnic lines. Hate speech has invaded social media. The government is reportedly attacking villages. Last month, the United Nations Commission on Human Rights in South Sudan took a 10-day trip to evaluate the situation, and they reported that, quote, the scale of rape of women and girls is mind-boggling. Ken Scott is a commissioner in this group. He just returned from the country and presented the commission's findings in front of the United Nations.
Certainly one of the biggest disappointments about the situation in South Sudan is that a tremendous amount of international goodwill, a tremendous amount of good feeling in the country in 2011 has really been squandered. I believe the Secretary General of the UN himself said that never has so much goodwill been squandered in the birth of a country where expectations were high and international support was also extensive, and yet we are where we are today.
What failed the South Sudanese people?
I think looking back, a number of people would probably say that, or at least raise a question whether the country was really ready for independence. Unfortunately, that part of Sudan, which became South Sudan, has been in armed conflict most of its history, even since the late 50s, with very short intervals of what passed for peace in that situation. So the country has really grown up in an armed conflict context over the past 60 years. The country is highly militarized and at the same time very tribal. There was really not a history or culture there of civil governance. There's a lack of a national identity there. People still tend to identify themselves tribally as opposed to considering themselves South Sudanese.
And so what you've observed is that as much as the civil governance institutions were going to try to prevent this, South Sudan has become like one-time Rwanda, where the ethnic differences are much more important than what it is civically that brings them together.
I think that's basically right. I would just caveat the comparison to Rwanda, although that's been said a number of times in the last few weeks, and we may have said it, the commission may have said it itself. We're not there. We're not at a Rwanda situation yet, thank goodness. But what we and others have been saying over the past month is that the signs are there, the trends are there, and that's what concerns us.
What have you observed in your visits?
Well, some really tragic things, of course. There are a number of protection of civilian camps that the UN has established in the country. I've been in a number of them. The needs are terrific. There's one camp up in Malakal and Bentu in that region. There's a camp that's 100,000 people. It's literally a small city. Outside of the camps, what we have noticed, and one of the reasons for the increased alarm at what's happening, is that everywhere you go, there is a more highly ethnically charged environment, even in parts of the country which up until maybe 6 months ago had escaped most of the violence. Now when you go there and when you talk to people, there is much more awareness, much more insecurity, much more of an ethnically charged environment. And that's one of the things that makes us increasingly concerned just because of the way that's changed over the past few months.
I'm getting a pretty hopeless impression from you, Ken. I mean, I can hear in your voice the sense of the international community really, you know, standing in the face of a very resistant set of forces on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right. You know, one of the things that work here is the classic confrontation of the need or desire by some for more robust international intervention on the one hand, and traditional notions of sovereignty on the others. South Sudan, of course, says that it is a sovereign country, that its territory must be honored and respected. There's a lot of regional politics. The neighboring countries all have various of their own interests and agendas, Ethiopia, Kenya, Uganda, Sudan, which complicates the picture. You have African continental politics. Unfortunately, there's a great resistance on the continent now. Not everywhere, there are exceptions, but there's a great resistance to concepts of international justice, of accountability. And there again, although words are often said that sound good, that they support the fight against impunity, again, it's unfortunately another situation where actions don't come up to the same level as words.
So what's the next step? I mean, what can really prevent this from sliding into what it sounds like is an inevitable civil war?
Well, a number of things have been tried over the past month. I don't think any one of them is a golden bullet. The United States put forward, I don't think they ever actually formally put it on the table, so to speak, but they made an effort about a few weeks ago to achieve an arms embargo and targeted sanctions against three additional of the senior political and military leaders in the country in the Security Council. Unfortunately, after counting possible votes, the likely votes, they could not get the necessary 9 votes to pass that resolution. I understand from things I've heard in the last day or two that the United States, the UN Ambassador Samantha Power, intends to put that resolution forward again between now and the end of the year. Other things are that the peace agreement that was signed about 16 months ago provides for a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, also for a hybrid court, an international hybrid court to hold people accountable. Unfortunately, very, very little progress has been made on either of those fronts. The commission believes that one of the root causes of the current conflict is a deep culture of impunity, lack of accountability over this long period of violence that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and that establishing real accountability and showing to the people of South Sudan that this time it's going to be different, that people will be held accountable, we think that is a major step that must be taken, and we are calling for prompt implementation of the hybrid court so that these cases can be put together and prosecuted.
Ken Scott is UN Commissioner on Human Rights in South Sudan. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
There are sounds and words that feel as big as pictures sometimes. Poetry could be that way. Hip-hop's combination of poetry and raw emotion can certainly fill a frame with sound and pictures. In this case, the picture of a U.S. president.
An open letter to the fat, arrogant, anti-charismatic, national embarrassment known as President John Adams. The man's irrational. He claims that I'm in league with Britain in some vast international intrigue. Trick, please. You wouldn't know what I'm doing. You're always going berserk, but you never show up to work. Give my regards to Abigail next time you write about my...
It's the award-winning performer Watsky's contribution to the hit Hamilton mixtape, an offshoot of the successful Lin-Manuel Miranda musical phenomenon, Hamilton. Watsky's track is called An Open Letter. And Watsky's been doing spoken word poetry since he was about 15 in the Bay Area. He has several albums, the latest, Time's Infinity, as well as a book collection of autobiographical essays called How to Ruin Everything. Watsky's part of a small but influential group of artists that includes Lin-Manuel Miranda and Hamilton star and rapper David Diggs. Watsky notes that among the pictures we're not likely to see in the coming Trump years are of slam poetry gatherings in the White House. President Obama hosted such a poetry event at the White House early in his first term and invited Lin-Manuel Miranda and David Diggs. It was an event that then Daily Show host Jon Stewart panned. Watsky says Stewart missed the point back then, and he hopes the love of hip-hop doesn't diminish in the coming years.
When Jon Stewart did that piece, a part of my heart died because I love Jon Stewart so much, and I wanted him to love it. I wanted America to see. I wanted Obama to present spoken word to America and America to fall in love with it the way I fell in love with it when I was 15. And I think the fact is it's still somewhat niche. It's still not for everybody because of the nature of it and emotional impact of it. But it was so exciting to see it start to be experienced on that level and have a president of the United States coming out of the Bush presidency, bring it into the White House was unbelievable.
Well, it certainly advanced far from that moment in 2008. But, you know, you've got the chance right now to have America fall in love with your niche.
And then the internet provides that possibility too. Whereas if you were a musician and in the Saul days and talk about Most Def, like this constellation of labels that was like Raucous, Def Jux, Rhymesayers in Minneapolis, Quantum in the Bay Area, these quote unquote underground indie labels that had a niche that was separate from the mainstream really had to be separate because it was pre-internet music sharing. But now the mainstream and the underground are completely cross-pollinated with each other. And because you don't need a major label gatekeeper to approve your stuff, you can do whatever you want. And I think it's resulted for, you know, all the bad stuff that's out there in a golden age of music and creativity and artists who are able to bypass major label gatekeepers to make the kind of art they want to.
Creatively and artistically, what do you want to jump into? What kind of genre? What kind of medium would you love to jump into?
Well, I just finished an album that felt in some ways like a cap to this series of albums that I did that were very autobiographical. And I feel like I've been writing about myself for a long time, although this album was more political than any of my previous ones. I mean, in high school, I wrote like a hip hop spoken word play and I went to school for dramatic writing. I want to write more stuff that bridges the gaps between genres. There's a lot of my friends doing it right now, and, you know, I don't think it'll be theater, but I'm excited about doing more prose writing, crossing prose and poetry and music.
Do you feel that you're a member of the disability community and that you have to advocate as a member of the disability community as an artist?
Well, for having epilepsy?
Right.
I don't know if I want to take that mantle just because I don't want to do a disservice to other people who have conditions that affect their lives more on a daily basis than mine does. I mean, I am medicated. I take an anticonvulsant every day. I have seizures occasionally, but I have a lot of epileptic fans that come to my shows and their conditions are much more serious than mine and have seizures every single day.
You have epileptic fans that come to your show?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
how do you know?
They tell me. Yeah. I mean, I wait afterwards at every show and I meet everyone who wants to stick around. People send me emails and there's people who have sent me emails saying, like, we're proud that you're openly epileptic. You have material about it. I have songs and I have poems about it and I have a chapter in my book about it. And my goal is to acknowledge that I have epilepsy and that it affects my life without being like the quote unquote epileptic rapper and using it as a crutch to advance my career.
Are you moved to give us a lyric?
Sure. I'd be happy to. This is called Tiny Glowing Screens Part 2. There's 7,046,000,000 people on the planet and most of us have the audacity to think we matter. Hey, hear the one about the comedian who croaked? They stabbed him in the heart, just a little poke, but he keeled over because he went into battle wearing chainmail made of jokes. Hey, hear the one about the screenwriter who passed away? He was giving elevator pitches and the elevator got stuck halfway. He ended up eating smushed sandwiches they pushed through a crack in the door and repeating the same crappy screenplay idea about talking dogs till his last day. Hey, hear the one about the fisherman who passed? He didn't jump off that ledge, he just stepped out into the air and then pulled the ground up towards him really fast. Like he was pitching a line and went fishing for concrete. The earth is a drum and he's hitting it on beat. The reason there's smog in Los Angeles is because if we could see the stars, if we could see the context of the universe in which we exist, we could see how small each one of us really is against the vastness of what we don't know, then nobody would ever audition for a McDonald's commercial again, and then where would we be? No frozen dinners and no TV, and is that a world we really want to text in? Either someone just microwaved popcorn, or I hear the sound of 1,000 people pulling the heads out of their asses in rapid succession. The people are hunched over in Boston. They're starting screen printing companies and app stores in San Francisco. They're grinning in Los Angeles like they got fish hooks in the corners of their mouth. But don't paint me like the good guy, because every time I write, I get to choose the angle that you view me and select the nicest light. You would not respect me if you heard the typewriter chatter tap, tap, tapping through my mind at night, the same stupid tape loop of old sitcom dialogue and tattered memories of some girl I got to grind and in high school filed carefully on rice paper. My heart is a colored pencil, but my brain is an eraser. I don't want a real girl. I want a tracer from a catalog. Truth be told, I'm unlikely to hold you down, because my soul is a crowded subway train and people keep deciding to get in the next one that rolls through town. I'm joining a false movement in San Francisco. I'm frowning and hunched over in Boston. I'm grinning in Los Angeles like I got fish hooks in the corners of my mouth, and I'm celebrating on weekends because there are 7,047,000,000 people on the planet, and I have the audacity to think that I matter. I know it's a lie, but I prefer it to the alternative because I got a tourniquet tied to my elbow. I got a blunt wrap filled with compliments and I'm burning it. You say go to sleep, but I've been bouncing off my bedroom walls since I was hecka small. We're every age at once and tucked inside ourselves like Russian nesting dolls. My mother is an 8-year-old girl. My grandson is a 74-year-old retiree whose kidneys just failed, and that is the glue between me and you. That is the screws and nails. We live in a house made of each other. And if that sounds strange, that's because it is. Would somebody please freeze time so I can run around turning everyone's pockets inside out? And remember, you didn't see.
That is just fabulous.
Thank you so much. I love writing spoken word, and it's
And again, you have that excitement that Lin-Manuel Miranda has. You know, like he did at the Tonys, he did that spontaneous thing. Love is love is love is love. I mean, I just love where you're coming from, and I just love that at this moment in the 21st century, this is a good thing. People are doing this.
It's really exciting, actually, to see the people who came up through Brave New Voices, which is the poetry event that I feel most closely connected to. It's the National Youth Poetry Slam. And people who I knew as teenagers, you know, when they were the kid who competed against me from Philadelphia, or someone I saw 3 years later who was on the Colorado team, someone who was from Wisconsin, there are so many of them who are now getting published in major journals, who are winning pushcart prizes, who are bringing their work to Broadway and to music, who fell in love with poetry the exact same way I did. I'm one of many young people who represents this tradition, and less younger now than I was when I was a teenager, but who came up through this world and are forming networks, who are breaking down stigmas against spoken word poetry in the print poetry world. And it's really starting to happen, and I think it's just more and more going to filter out there, and to see friends and friends of friends start to make it. It's very exciting.
Watsky, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Watsky is rapper and lyricist whose latest album is called Time's Infinity, and his collection of autobiographical essays is called How to Ruin Everything. ...2016, slipping away. What photo resonated with you in this year? 877-8-MY-TAKE or head to The Takeaway's Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.